case this morning, and we have high school students with us today with our Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. We invite students to come for oral argument, and if that invitation is accepted, they will come to oral argument. They will get materials about the case. They may have done some work on this case, and then we'll meet with a justice at the conclusion of a case we're about to hear. Everyone is welcome to attend that session at noon in this courtroom. It will be a discussion of the processes of the court, not the substance of the case. So let me extend on behalf of the court a welcome to Wauwatosa East High School students. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Let me introduce the court to all of you. Starting on my left is Justice Patience Rogensack. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and you will be meeting with me right after this case is concluded for our discussion. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Diane Sykes. The introductions made, I'll call our case 02-3328, Hutchinson Technology, Inc. versus Labor Industry and Review Commission. And we have a number of people arguing. The first will be Carol Dittmar for 15 minutes, then Timothy, representing Hutchinson Technology, then Timothy G. Costello, representing the Amicus Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, Inc. Then we will have Rose M. Allen, representing Susan Roytek, for 15 minutes, and 15 minutes for David Rice, Assistant Attorney General, representing LURC. Did I have the lineup correct? All right. And Mr. Dittmar, you get, Ms. Dittmar, you get 5 minutes in rebuttal. So we'll start with Attorney Carol S. Dittmar, representing Hutchinson Technology.
Thank you, Chief Justice, members of the court, counsel, and students. I went to high school in Wauwatosa, and I'm feeling a little old right now. But I represent the petitioner, Hutchinson Technology, Inc. I'm with the Garvey Anderson firm in Eau Claire, and it is an honor to be here this morning. Hutchinson Technology is a manufacturer of disk drive, computer disk drive assemblies. If you picture a very small, one of those old-fashioned record players with LPs, that's what they manufacture at the Eau Claire facility. And that's the device that reads data for the computers that we throw around. They opened the facility in Eau Claire in 1995. And when they opened the facility in 1995, they began operations with a four-shift schedule. These are shifts that do not work a static day or time or static days in the week. They work 3 days 1 week, 4 days another, and every other weekend. And Hutchinson determined to put this sort of a schedule in place as a result of cost efficiencies. In utilizing this schedule, they can run the plant 24/7. There's no downtime in utilizing this schedule. And in addition, they took some input or some data from employees on what type of a schedule they would prefer. You know, for example, an employer could run a 24/7 operation just utilizing 3 8-hour shifts, but the employees appear to prefer this type of a shift, and that's what was enacted, and that's how they have operated continuously, members of the court, since 1995. As a result, they have individuals that work 12-hour shifts, again, on this rotating schedule. Now, at no time has Hutch in the Eau Claire location ever had a job share or any part-time programs, any sort of a shift other than this 12-hour shift on this rotating schedule. Now, Susan Roytek, the plaintiff in the lower court litigation, made application for employment at Hutchinson in 1998.
Counselor, let me just interrupt you just very quickly. You said they have always used a 12-hour shift, but I thought I read in the briefs that at some point she was invited to apply for an 8-hour shift when it became clear that she had a permanent difficulty with working a 12-hour shift. Did I read that wrong? Or?
You didn't read it wrong, Justice Rogan-Sagan. What I can do is clarify. The manufacturing facility is on the 12-hour shift on four-crew rotating schedule. The vast majority of employees that work at the Eau Claire location are in the manufacturing facility.
Okay.
There's a minority of folks that work in the administrative, the quote-unquote front office aspect of Hutch, and those individuals work on an 8-hour shift.
Okay.
And that's what was referred to in the
Thank
briefs.
You.
Also, one other clarification. So, as I understand it, she was unable to perform 3 out of 4 jobs that they had for her, but she was able to perform desk work. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And is that so? What you're saying is that the desk work that she was able to perform, was that a 12-hour? Was that, I mean, tell me, it was 8 hours of desk work, but she was unable to sit for long or stand for long periods of time, correct?
Again, I believe clarification is necessary, Justice Wilcox. She was hired for a manufacturing position, and she knew, and that's indeed what she wanted. She was given a tour of the facility. There are a variety of positions that were available, and she chose this particular one in the, quote, photo-etched division.
Which doesn't exist anymore.
That's correct. That closed down in April of 2000. But now, in the photo-etch manufacturing position, Justice Wilcox, there was a requirement that they rotate into 4 areas, and I believe that's what you were referring to. Now, one of those areas, one of the areas in the manufacturing position required some book work, where they just had to deal with reports, how many pieces were produced, that sort of thing. Now, but what Justice Rogan-Sack was referring to is that when it became apparent, or when we received the restrictions that she could no longer work this 12-hour manufacturing position, there were 8-hour administrative positions that were available as well, which she could have posted for. But now those administrative positions are different from that manufacturing position. In addition, they're different from the bookwork section of that one manufacturing position. And then if I could also clarify, she was terminated by Hutchinson when we received the doctor's restriction indicating that she could no longer work the 12-hour shift, that she could only work 8 hours. And again, there was nothing preventing her from posting for these 8-hour administrative positions. But Justice Wilcox, there was a period of time where we accommodated some reduced hour restrictions. In fact, it wasn't the insignificant period of time either. She began work in June of 1998, knew it was a 12-hour position. We told her that. She indicated there was no problem with it and she could work that position. Approximately September, October, 3 or 4 months into her employment, she was completely taken off work due to basically back difficulties. Came back in November 98 with a 6-hour restriction shift. That was eventually increased to 8 hours.
And that's the max.
Pardon?
8 hours is her max by the doctor's orders.
Correct. And then eventually that restriction, those temporary restrictions, were declared permanent. And that was the precipitating factor that led to her termination.
When we're clarifying, how long was it that you accommodated her at the 8-hour shifts?
Approximately 8 months.
8 months.
Right.
And you're now, as I understand it, arguing that such an accommodation is an unreasonable accommodation. Is that correct?
In addition to other arguments, but that is that, first of all, Justice Crooks, our position is that it is a 12-hour job.
I understand that. But isn't the argument that the 8 hours that you accommodated her for 8 months is an unreasonable accommodation, that it places an undue burden on Hutchinson?
On a permanent basis, that an employer, and we certainly did on a temporary basis, and indeed I submit, Justice Crux, that it was an extended temporary basis that we attempted to work with this lady. And in addition, Justice Wilcox asked about the four-unit rotation. Right. We also accommodated her inability to rotate completely through those four positions. So not only we accommodated both the limited hour limitation, we also accommodated an inability to do a complete rotation during this period. And then it was only when her 8-hour restrictions became permanent that we indicated that we were going to terminate this individual.
Does it require you to hire temporary workers to accommodate? In other words, how do you work that out as far as everyone's working 12 and she was working, say, 8?
There was no proof that we hired, we went to manpower, you know, generically I use the term, to come in and fill that 4-hour shift. There was testimony in the record indicating that the fellow employees agreed to help her out, you know, picked up the slack, attempted to do what they could in order that the same production goals were met during this particular.
Okay, so how is this different from, say, Crystal Lake? Because in the Crystal Lake case, the fellow employees came in, or they were, this is a cheese company case, and helped out. Why is that different here? What's the difference?
In Crystal Lake, there was an individual, and the decision referred to her on a first-name basis. I mean no respect, but I'll do the same. Her name was Caitlin. And this court, in a 4-3 decision, found that there were certain job responsibilities or a job description that had to be performed. And then it found that there were other people, in particular her mother and her sister, who agreed that they would perform these tasks. In other words, the duties would begin to be distributed differently.
Yes.
And the court said, well, that's okay, regardless if the employer says we want everybody to do these particular tasks. But here, Hutchinson has indicated, Hutchinson, you know, did not come up with this 12-hour, four-shift, alternate working day schedule out of the cloth. They did that based upon studies and what sort of a production schedule would result in an efficient use of the property, plant, and equipment, and man that facility 24/7. There was no discriminatory intent that Hutchinson used in coming up with this schedule, nor has any been even suggested. And they have said this is the job. It's a 12-hour job. Now, the issue I submit that we've got a statute that indicates that it's not discrimination. In 11.322, it indicates that it is not prohibited employment discrimination because of disability to terminate from employment any individual if the disability is reasonably related to the individual's ability to adequately undertake the job-related responsibilities of that individual's employment. So query, what are the job-related responsibilities of the manufacturing position at Hutch? And I submit the 12-hour shift is a job responsibility. So then the issue is can, in this particular case, Susan Roytek, can she perform that job with or without a reasonable accommodation? And there is nothing that Hutchinson could have done in order to allow Ms. Roytek to work a 12-hour shift. Justice Wilcox, in Crystal Lake, this court found that there were accommodations that would allow Caitlin to do that job within her hours. Here we've got a 12-hour shift, and there isn't anything we can do to make Ms. Roytek work that 12-hour shift.
So on the facts, you're saying that this differs from Crystal Lake.
It does.
Because the court is bound by Crystal Lake. You understand that even...
Bill, did I think that my case would have anything to do with a statute of repose case, but I sat through those arguments and I understood and I appreciated the arguments of stare decisis, and I'm also very familiar with Crystal Lake, Justice. Justice Abrahams?
Well, your position then is that reasonable accommodation does not mean decreasing the hours from the regular shift or decreasing the work day from the regular work day. Is that your position?
As is what I've come to know your custom, Justice Abrahamson, you've cut it to the quick right away, is...
That's not going to get you my vote.
All right, sorry. My apologies. But you know, who calls the job responsibilities? Isn't there some core element of a job, both the responsibilities and the schedule, that an employer still has the right to do, to formulate, to operate their businesses? Aren't Wisconsin employers still entitled to do that without court intervention or administrative agency intervention?
You know, that's a very appealing argument. And you can do that. You can do that as long as you don't violate the public policy of the state to protect disabled people.
And
because employers, the legislature says, that employers perceive or actually think people who are different can't do a job. And the legislature says, uh-uh, you've got to make reasonable accommodation for disabled persons, right?
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that there should be no oversight, or will there be never any oversight. By definition, there will always be some interference. But I submit, Chief Justice, that there are some duties that an employer has the right to state, we have to have employees be able to do this. Whether they're disabled, green, or purple, they have to meet these particular requirements in order for us to manufacture our product or put out our service.
Well, isn't that why you have reasonable accommodation and the hardship rule? Because that protects the employer. The employer can show that there is no reasonable accommodation, or that there is a reasonable accommodation, but that it's a hardship, you're home free.
And, in fact, that's what indeed has happened to date in the various LURC decisions that I've cited for the court, with the exception of this one, relative to individuals who cannot work more than 8 hours a day. And of interest is the one that was decided even after this case, that being Ludwig versus Kohler. And I put the text of all of these LURC decisions in our appendix, in which it was an individual applied for work over at Kohler over on the east side of the state, could only work 8 hours a day, and the employer didn't give her the job because she couldn't work the required 12-hour shift at Kohler. And the LURC found, okay, that's not discrimination, because in that particular case, there was a CBA, a collective bargaining agreement, that was a union shop, whereas here Hutchinson is not a union shop. However, then I refer this court to the United States Supreme Court case, which we cited in a reply brief, U.S. Airways versus Barnett, which indicates that a uniformly applied attendance requirement is not discriminatory.
I know, but that was where if I remember the case correctly, where he didn't show up on time, he was tardy, that kind of thing.
No, that was somebody who was trying to bid into a position, and there was a seniority issue, that he was disabled, he had another back condition, it was a mailroom situation, and he wanted to bid into another department. This is the USA Airways case now.
Okay.
And they said, no, you know, we can't do that because the union, we've got individuals who have seniority with the union, and we can't bump the union rights. So, but again, that case came down and said that employer uniformly enforced employer standards should have the same effect as those dictated by a CBA, by a collective bargaining agreement. And I submit that the same should apply here. Hutch uniformly applied this 12-hour shift limitation. That was a job responsibility.
And you don't think the collective bargaining agreements made any difference then?
If Hutch was a union shop and they had a CBA, apparently, according to LURC, it makes a difference. Okay. There'd be no discrimination pursuant to what I understand is LURC's rationale. I see that my time is up.
Right. 15 minutes goes fast when you're having fun.
I have one quick question before you get down. Did Ms. Roytek ever post for an 8-hour job?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dittmer.
Thank you.
Attorney Costello.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of WMC with some very limited issues. One is, who has the burden of proof to show that accommodation is or is not reasonable? And what is that? What do those words really mean, reasonably accommodate? Both issues, in my mind, are cases of first or infrequent impression in front of the court. There has been this, we know for sure that under McClellan and some of the other cases, Target, that there is a distinction between reasonable accommodation and hardship. And I would submit to you the term reasonable accommodation equalizes an employer's responsibility under the law, as well as the employee's responsibility under the law, whether it's the Piggly Wiggly in Wauwatosa or Sheboygan, or the Walmart Supercenter in West Bend. The point is that there has to be a reasonable accommodation that's both effective and that is proportional in cost.
Effective meaning what? Employee can do it?
In this case, it's getting Ms. Reitek up to 12 hours in a day. Or if an employee comes in with a 8-hour shift and says, I can only work 7, coming up with a solution that you work through your lunch break, giving her a faster computer so she can get all her work done in 7. There's no evidence in the record in this case as to how Ms. Reitek was going to get 12 hours of production done in 8 hours. The other complication you have in this case is you have two 12-hour shifts for maximizing this employer's assets 7 days a week. There's not 28 hours in a day that somebody could come in and make up their production. I suppose you could compel somebody to stay over and work a 16-hour day, or compel somebody to come in earlier their shift and work 16 hours. And that's Crystal Lake's a little, you know, there's a mother and a sister helping a relative there. We don't have that, nor did Ms. Reitek come forward with any evidence anywhere near that.
Well, it doesn't sound very accommodating of you to insist that it be exactly the same.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about what we did do, or what Hutch did do for Ms. Reitek. She was not eligible for family medical leave because she hadn't worked there long enough, but they gave her a leave of absence from September of 98 to November of 98. Didn't fire. You're on leave of absence. Reasonable accommodation. They raised her desk. Reasonable accommodation. They allow her to vary her tasks so she wouldn't have to stand or sit over a microscope. Reasonable accommodation. They allowed her to come back to work from November 98 to January of 99 on a 6-hour limitation. Reasonable accommodation. Then that went to 8 hours from January 25th, 99 to August 10th, 99. Only working 8 hours. Reasonable accommodation. So then we get to the crux of the issue. There are certain core requirements of jobs that deserve greater scrutiny by LURC, administrative law judges, and ultimately the court when it comes to reasonable accommodation. And we've seen cases like this. Target. Did the court say that we have to permanently let somebody sleep on the job? No. The court said temporary forbearance. What did Hutch do here? They temporarily forbear enforcing the 12-hour requirement. Exactly what? What did Hutch do next? Well, maybe you got to think about bidding on an open 8-hour job in May. That's McClellan. A vacant position. That's a form of attempted accommodation in that regard. The point is, we go through this whole process, and you're left with what tool, what piece of equipment, what change can we make to get you to do 4 more hours of production, which everybody else does, and there is none. There is no reasonable accommodation.
If the 12 hours is so important, how were they able to operate for the 8 months that you've just described?
They suffered with it. It's just like...
What was the result? I mean, how did they suffer with it?
You got 4 hours less production out of a person.
And they paid for 4 hours less work?
No. My understanding, I'll let Mr.
They paid her for 12 when she worked for 8?
No. My understanding is she was only paid for the time she worked. So some weeks she would work 24 hours, the next week she would work 32 hours based on the 3-4 swing schedule.
Counselor, these laws against discriminating in employment apply to hiring as well as to termination, right?
Correct.
And if LURC was right in their decision. Would it mean you can never hire anybody for a longer shift than 8 hours? If the person says, well, I want to apply for this job, it's a 12-hour job, but hey, I can only work 8 hours. If you have to make a reasonable accommodation for this employee, don't you have to make one for everyone that applies?
It depends on the job. As you saw in the Van Zandy case, there was some accommodation to let the employee work 16 hours a week at home. There may be some jobs where...
I'm talking about your job. I'm not talking about a lot of other
Probably jobs. Not. When you go from 8 to 12 and it's in a manufacturing setting, very seldom can you do manufacturing at home, and usually it's a line operation or an integrated operation, and you need that person there. If that person's not there, not as much gets done. And that's true of an office setting, for that matter.
But if the issue is, as Justice Rogensack raises, that if five people apply and they say, well, we have physical infirmities which would not allow us to do 12-hour of work, if we apply and say, no, that you did not make reasonable accommodations or whatever, that the law doesn't discriminate between the person there and the person applying, then hypothetically, Hutchison would then have to employ those people if openings were there, and they would be accommodated by 8 hours. Is that correct? I mean,
that's the way the Court of Appeals and the lower courts have ruled. And these core requirements I'm talking about is things like disciplinary rules. You don't yell at your boss and you're not insubordinate. Well, somebody may have a disability or going through medication adjustment that may, where they have anger bursts. And it seems to me that Target says, wait a minute, you may have to tolerate that for a little bit temporarily. But we don't sit there and cross out your disciplinary rules and say, Judy can yell at the boss whenever she wants because she has a disability. There's certain norms or codes, code of conducts or requirements. Barnett case is a classic example. Barnett was not a collective bargaining agreement. It was a uniformly implemented and applied seniority system. And the disabled worker wanted to circumvent it. And the employer said no. And the court did, to lie some of the justices' fears, the court did say, hey, wait a minute, there may be some special circumstances where a uniformly implemented program plan, seniority rule, in our case a work schedule, may have to be changed. One, you don't fairly apply it. Two, maybe it was designed to screen out people with disabilities. But here there's no evidence in this case. There was a good, legitimate business reason why there's 12-hour shifts.
Counselor, is a reasonable accommodation a question of fact or a question of law? Is that determination of what is a reasonable accommodation,
I think it's
fact or law?
I think it's a mixed question, Your Honor.
I think it's mixed. Okay, how so?
I think because it's a case-by-case analysis, you're going to have to look at the particular employer's facts and resources and the operation. And then the word reasonable, I think, is ultimately a conclusion of law, given those specific facts.
Thank you.
Working at home is another example as to when does that become a reasonable accommodation, just like working only 8 versus the 12 required. I think those kind of cases require a little more scrutiny. I think the Van Zandy case, which the state of Wisconsin was the employer in the case, in front of the Seventh Circuit, demonstrates that. There's the effectiveness and the effectiveness in terms of the, you know, there's, if Ms. Roytek could point to some item we could have done, some additional step we could have taken, or perhaps even more work hardening, maybe go up to 10 and then 12, then the statute corresponds with the employer's needs to run a business in an efficient manner and, you know, optimize the use of its assets. But there's none of that here. What we do know is there were 3 or 4 or 5 steps, one attempted step to get her into a different job, and then at the end, she said, Ms. Roytek didn't come forward with any request, proposal, suggestion of how she would get that additional 4 hours of labor production done. Just, I'm going home. You figure it out. That's not a reasonable accommodation.
Counsel, it's my understanding that you believe that Roytek bears the burden of proof regarding whether the accommodation is reasonable.
That's correct.
Burden of proof usually is a matter of fact. not law, right?
Right.
So, but you answered the question about is reasonable accommodation fact or law to say it's a mixed question. So I don't quite understand why we're talking about burden of proof. Because the facts, if it's a mixed question, the fact would be matters such as how'd you get the 12 hours, why that's important in your schedule, whether you can have two people work the job, do you have a shared job, et cetera. But then the question as to whether or not those facts meet that test would be law. So are you just saying that it's the burden on the employee to prove these facts?
Yes, I think it's the burden on the employee to come forward and say that I'm disabled, I made a request, this is what I need, and it's reasonable in the sense that it will be effective. I can work 12 hours, and there's a proportional cost to it.
Yeah, but now, why would the employee, I can see where the employee could say, look, I can work 8 hours. That's pretty easy to figure out, or 6 hours. How would the employee be able to determine a proportional cost? That's not within an employee's knowledge. That's something that you would know.
Something as simple as
you, I mean the company.
I think there's obviously a discussion, and there's certainly requests made, information asked for, but there's enough. When an employee comes in and says, "I need my desk adjustable so I can go up and down. I have one like that at a home, or I had that one. This is how I did it in my last job." There's a wealth of information there from the employee in terms of what they're capable of doing, the medical information, as well as how they've done it in their prior jobs or personal life.
And Lurk agrees with you. Lurk said that the burden should rest on the employee to begin with to demonstrate a particular accommodation might be reasonable. I agree with you on that, and that's what you've said.
Right.
But who has the ultimate burden?
I think it remains with the employee.
I think it remains with the employee. Okay.
And that was obviously...
That's why you're here.
There's no evidence in the record that supports that burden. Thank you.
Let me just, while we still have you, and who proves hardship? Who has the burden of proof?
I think it's the employer has the burden of hardship.
How does hardship differ from proportionality and cost?
I think hardship is, if you look at the case law, is hardship is a defense that's only available to a small employer. To say that a Walmart has to rebuild a bathroom, how's Walmart ever going to prove hardship, even though, you know, there's alternative accommodation?
Well, but that sounds like proportionality and cost.
No, I think hardship is far more significant. Proportionality and cost is looking at the requested accommodation, looking at the cost of the requested accommodation, and does it really... Is there another alternative? Does the cost really justify, or is there a cheaper alternative? Are we arguing about the most reasonable accommodation, or are we arguing about a reasonable accommodation in proportionality?
Okay.
Well, doesn't that undercut your argument using Walmart? Well, here you've got a Hutchison employs 1,000 people.
Right.
If you had a company that had 12-hour shifts and they had 4 employees, and then they would have to, the accommodation would have to, well, they'd have to hire someone part-time to come in and make up for that extra 4 hours. But in a company of this size, I guess my question is, why wouldn't you be able to? I understand the who runs the company. The company does, and they set this standard, and apparently here the employees wanted this, but doesn't that make a better argument when it's for a smaller company than it's...
With regard to hardship, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think a smaller company has obviously less resources.
Right.
And less backup plans, less staff, and the hardship defense is easier for a smaller company to make. That's why the... You know, when you interpret the word reasonable, it kind of puts big employers, small employers, and large employers all on the same footing, you know, within an industry. A grocery store is a grocery store.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Allen.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Rose Allen. I represent Susan Roytek along with my co-counsel, Lisa Weibusch. I will be speaking for the first 15 minutes of this time, and Mr. David Rice will be speaking for the remaining 15 minutes. Mr. Rice will be speaking on the definition of disability and also on the issues raised by the amicus brief filed by the Wisconsin manufacturers.
On what? I'm sorry, you turned away from the microphone. He's going to speak on disability and what else?
And on the issues raised by the Wisconsin manufacturers in their amicus brief.
Okay. Burden of proof.
Correct. Your Honors, this is not a complicated case. It's not an unusual disability case. It comes down to applying the rules that were in effect in this case since 1987 with the LaCrosse decision. Both parties knew what their burden of proof was. Both parties knew what they had to establish. In this case, the employers completely failed to establish or prove any of their defenses with regard to reasonable accommodation or undue hardship.
Counselor, if a reasonable accommodation is to work 8-hour shifts rather than the 12 hours that the line is set up for, don't they have to apply? I mean, don't they have to hire then? Everyone that comes in and says, I have a disability, my doctor says I can only work 12 hours, but, you know, you'll have to make some accommodation for them. Don't they have to hire everybody that knocks on their door, if I buy your argument?
They don't have to hire everyone. First of all, the employee or the potential employee has to prove that they have an impairment that may be.
Right. We're just going to assume that they have an impairment. It's exactly the same as Ms. Roytek's, okay, but they're applying for the job. We've got 10 people at the door, and they need this job very badly. Doesn't Hutchinson have to change its shift to accommodate those 10 people just as they do to her, if I buy your argument?
No, they don't have
Why
to
not?
Do that. They have to engage, and what the employer should be required to do is to engage in an interactive process with these potential employees, find out what sort of accommodation may...
I don't want to change any facts from what you have. From what I understand from your brief, the accommodation your client needs is an 8-hour shift.
That's correct.
Right? Okay. Everybody that's applying needs exactly that same accommodation as your client needs. So if I buy your argument, why don't they have to hire all those people or suffer being sued under Wisconsin Fair Employment Law?
They don't have to hire them all if they can show and if they demonstrate that by doing so it's not going to be a requested reasonable accommodation or it would be an undue hardship on the employer. They have to show that. They don't. I don't believe they satisfy their burden of proving undue hardship by just articulating something. They need to prove it. They need to explain to us why allowing these people to come in. We're not.
Why can't they just have as a condition of employment that everybody works 12-hour shifts? You're saying to me they can't. They have to prove. They have to prove that has to be a condition of employment, that they can't do business some other way. I don't read the law quite that broadly.
Well, I think the law requires the employer to reasonably accommodate, and in every particular employment situation is different, and what one employer is or isn't able to do, it depends on that employer.
I know you want to digress from me, but I want to keep you on track with only the facts we have before us, because it is these facts on which we have to base the core of our decision. And I frankly don't get an answer from you about why they don't have to apply and why they don't have to hire these other 10 people who look exactly like your client does in regard to the claimed disability for these shifts. So I'm having a hard time understanding that. Why don't they have to hire them? I mean, maybe they do, and maybe that's your answer.
Absolutely, Your Honor, you're right. They might have to do that if it's a reasonable accommodation and it's not going to be an undue hardship.
But you're saying it is a reasonable accommodation. That is the accommodation that you put out, right?
Right.
And you say, perforce, an 8-hour shift is a reasonable accommodation for a 12-hour job for this particular employer.
For under these particular facts with this particular employee.
Right.
This was a reasonable accommodation that was offered for 8 months, and it worked. The problems and the defenses that are raised by the employer didn't occur. They argue that, well, there's going to be production problems. There weren't production problems.
Well, what if you add 10 more people to it? I mean, do we get to treat these 10 people less favorably than your client because they got there second rather than first? At some point, you're certainly going to change the way the employer does business, aren't you?
Well, at some point, if it got to be that scenario, then the employer would have the ability to say, you know what, we can't accommodate anymore because it's not reasonable. It's going to cause undue hardship. We have the situation where we can't do that anymore and maintain the regular production schedule that we have. But it's not this case. This case, the reasonable accommodation worked.
Well, it worked because you had one person and it worked for a limited period of time. But what about all the other employees that are required to work for 12 hours? I mean, what does that do to their morale and they've got someone that gets to get off early?
Well, first of all, the employer has the burden of proving that there's a morale problem. In this case, the employer didn't prove there was a morale problem. It's all speculation. In order for the employer to meet their burden, they have to move their defense beyond speculation. In this case, there were no employees that complained. Their witnesses testified that there weren't any problems with employee morale. Ms. Roytek testified that there was no one that complained to her about problems. Ms. Detmer testified that there were people that said that they would pick up the slack for her. I don't know where that appears in the record, and maybe she can assist me with that. I don't recall seeing it. But the fact of the matter is, and we went through all of the reasonable accommodations that Hutchinson provided, and those were great, but they don't get to escape responsibility of complying with the Act by saying we reasonably accommodated for a while, but now we're not going to. We received no explanation why this couldn't continue, or why couldn't Ms. Roytek work an 8-hour shift 5 days a week, or if we were concerned about these extra 4 hours a week that she wasn't getting, why didn't the employer ask her, you know what, could you work an extra 4 hours on this day? There was no interactive process that occurred between the employer and between Ms. Roytek about what can you do. As soon as they found out there wasn't 12 hours that she could do, they didn't even contemplate it.
Counselor, why didn't she apply for an 8-hour job?
I think there were, and I have to recall from the facts, but part of the issue that came out was the way in which she was dismissed. She didn't receive any notice that this wasn't going to be allowed to continue indefinitely. So first of all, she didn't know that she should be looking for something else. Second of all, when she was dismissed from employment and placed on the short-term disability until her hours were used up, her badge was taken, her things were taken, and she was escorted from the building. She wasn't under the impression that she could just freely come back into the office or back into the building to look for job postings. She testified that she did make calls to see if there were any job openings available, but that there was not a lot of assistance in that regard.
Thank you.
When you look at the what the employer did in this case, like I said, we've got the Pandora's box of problems. They argue, well, production is a problem, but in fact, production was up during this period of reasonable accommodation. We talk about, well, the burden of proof. If the court were going to switch the burden of proof or change what the rules have been till now, she still met her burden of showing that the accommodation was reasonable because it worked. The employees testified that there weren't any staffing problems, there weren't scheduling problems. They could accommodate just about any disability. There weren't problems with resentment or employee morale problems. And Mr. Samelstead, who was a human resources generalist, said, if there were problems, I would have known about it. They testified about supposed costs, but they never told us what they were. They threw out reasons, but they didn't explain them. They didn't prove that this wouldn't work on a permanent basis. We've talked about job sharing, or maybe they would divide the shift into two shifts. Their employees testified that, well, yeah, we might consider doing that in the future, but we didn't consider it here. The employer has to at least consider the accommodations that are being requested and do that analysis about whether this is a reasonable accommodation and whether it's going to cause undue hardship for the employer. In this case, they simply didn't do it. In addition, there is no bright line rule about what will and won't be a reasonable accommodation for each employer. Every employment situation is different. what might be reasonable for one employer isn't going to be reasonable for another. So I don't believe that in this case there is a place to draw bright line rules for establishing this decision. It depends on the employer, and the employer certainly can protect itself from these sorts of claims by proving that it wasn't a reasonable accommodation or proving that there would be undue hardship upon it by providing this reasonable accommodation. The hearing examiner in this case made the finding that Ms. Roytek was able to do the position with the accommodations. It is supported by substantial evidence in the record. She was, in fact, performing all of the duties in her photo etch position, but just at the 8 hours. So under both the employer's doctor's opinion and under Ms. Roytek's testimony, she was able to perform the job, but just under 8 hours. It was an accommodation that worked. It did not cause any problems for the employer, and it should have been an accommodation that was permitted on a permanent basis. If there are no other questions, I will defer to Mr. Rice.
Fine. Thank you, Ms. Allen. David Rice, Assistant Attorney General, representing LIRC.
Good morning. I'm David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I appear in this case on behalf of the Labor and Industry Review Commission.
Well, would they have to hire those 10 people?
I'd like to address that. I'd like to see if I can persuade Justice Rogensack, and I'll get to that in just a moment if I might.
Okay.
When I was
at a moment, though, to get to
it. I understand. I only have 15.
Right.
when I was preparing this case, I thought back some 35 years to when I was a first-year law student taking legal process. And that was a very good course, and it focused on the development of workers' compensation law and the relationship between an emergent social problem, a legislative response, the creation of an administrative agency, rather than the legislature providing every detail in the workers' compensation law, they created an administrative apparatus. They provided for judicial review so that the agencies wouldn't exceed the bounds of reasonableness. And they obviously retained to themselves the power to change the law if there were problems in the way it was being implemented by the agencies and by the courts. And we have basically the same problem here in kind of the excellent academic thing to go back and look at. Employment discrimination laws were enacted to deal with a particular social problem. The Labor and Industry Review Commission and or its predecessor agencies were set up to administer the law, to fill in the details. The courts have been available and have been active through the years in reviewing their decisions. And at times, the legislature has responded. I'm not going to belabor the question of what's a disability. First of all, because I don't think this court has the power to even look at it. There's cases of this court that suggest that when the court has interpreted a statute and effectively given a judicial gloss to the statute, that this court, after a sufficient passage of time, is without power to change that interpretation, and only the legislature can change it.
Is that a rule of power or a rule of prudence?
I think it's the latter. And the
so
way
we're not talking about the court's power and
no,
what we may do. It's what we should do.
It's
or
what this court,
do.
The limits that this court has set on itself. You're absolutely right. And, of course, some cases there's been a precedent for 50 years, 65 years. But in some of these cases, it's been a much shorter time. For instance, in the case of Meyer versus Industrial Commission, which we cited in our brief, there was a 24-year period between the current case and the precedent decision. Cited in that case is Thomas versus Industrial Commission, where there was an 11-year period between those two decisions. In this case, we have a 17-year gap. So I would suggest to you that and Justice Sykes' words that you ought to forbear from deciding this issue as a matter of policy because of the long time that's elapsed. The legislature has done nothing in the interim to change the law or to alter your construction, nor have there been administrative decisions that have come to the court's attention as being such so outlandish that that the definition is too broad.
In other words, don't overrule lacrosse. Don't overrule lacrosse. That's your point.
I think we're both saying the same thing. You're talking about the lacrosse decision.
Absolutely talking about the lacrosse decision. And just two quick words, and then I'll get back to your initial question, Ms. Davidson, on the definition of disability. In the Chicago case, which was the 1974 case where this court first considered disability before there was a statutory definition, the court looked to the dictionary definition, which defined a handicap, which was the terminology at that time, as an disadvantage that makes achievement unusually difficult, colon, especially a disability that limits the capacity to work. But the court in that case didn't use both, and I think that's important. The court in that case said that, in that case, migraine, headaches, and asthma were the two disabilities. They thought that that was a type of disability that made achievement unusually difficult, but made no further mention of this limits the capacity to work. So when the legislature in 1981 amended the statute and said that disability, or handicap now disability, is an impairment which makes achievement unusually difficult or limits the capacity to work, I think you reasonably said in lacrosse that that means something, that the disjunctive or means something, and I think you reasonably construed the statute consistent with the way you construed it in Brown County. So I'm not going to belabor that. I think that your decision in Brown in lacrosse was correct, and I don't think you ought to revisit it at this time. Turning then to the question of reasonable disability and burden of proof, I don't know that
accommodation.
I'm sorry?
Reasonable accommodation.
I'm sorry. Reasonable accommodation and burden of proof. The question of burden of proof was never litigated in this case, as I tried to point out to this court in opposing participation of WMC in this case. And so I don't speak on behalf of a commission which has had the opportunity to consider it, nor would they be entitled to any particular deference simply because I'm here advocating a position on their behalf, unlike the situation where had you allowed the opportunity to arise where they could have decided that issue and then it came before the court, they would be entitled to greater deference in review of their decision. On the question of burden of proof, and this gets to what you asked of counsel, Justice Abramson, I think of burden of proof as relating to questions of fact primarily, and so it's a bit odd that we're talking about who has the burden to prove reasonableness of an accommodation when that's a statutory concept. Let me throw in a parenthetical here, too. Is it a question of fact or a question of law to prove reasonableness, is what you asked, Justice Rogensack. I think that the cases could suggest either outcome. There certainly are a line of cases like Nodelson that say anytime you apply a statutory definition to a fact situation, that's a question, a conclusion of law. I think there are cases like McMullen, which seem to intimate that it's a question of fact. There is Justice Crook's dissent in the CBS case, which suggests that in some cases it's closer to a question of fact. For my purposes, I don't think it really matters much because I think that you apply great weight deference to the commission's legal determinations. You apply substantial evidence review to their factual determinations. So if they're reasonable in either event, their decision needs to be affirmed. But on the question of burden of proof, if we have to discuss that question, and you asked us to brief it, and I have, and I spent a lot of time on it without coming to a conclusion that I feel terribly strongly about, but at least would share with you what I found in my research. I think that the cases are pretty clear, both the federal cases under the ADA, primarily those cases, suggest that the employee has the burden of suggesting a reasonable accommodation in the first place, except maybe in those very odd cases where the information is so within the knowledge of the employer that you don't even impose that initial step. But let's say that the employee has the burden of showing that an accommodation is reasonable. Then the burden shifts to the employer. In all of these cases, it's at least a burden of production to show either that it's unreasonable or it becomes the employer's burden of proof in some cases to show that it's a hardship. Everybody agrees that hardship's a burden of proof. So where I get trouble with these cases is I have a hard time distinguishing what is a hardship and what is a reasonable accommodation in any particular case. Because I know in McMullen, the Court of Appeals said they're separate and distinct concepts. But even in that case, they acknowledge there's some overlap between hardship and accommodation.
Doesn't it relate to the level of generality that the terms are operating under? I mean, an accommodation might be reasonable at a high level of generality, assuming an average employer, but be a hardship to a particular employer?
That's right. Or it might be reasonable in a particular, it might be reasonable, but still so costly, as another way of looking at it. I think that's the usual way of looking at it.
And isn't that the way the cases usually distinguish it, too?
I think so, but they really struggle with that. And most of the cases don't reach this particular issue of who has the burden of proving something is reasonable or unreasonable. Most of the cases, the employee shows asks for an accommodation, and if the parties have engaged in the interactive process envisioned by Beckon that you, I think, gave some approval to in Crystal Lake, before they get to litigation, they'll know what the issues are in the case.
Is it helpful to think of it as a prima facie case with a light touch on the part of the employee?
Initially, right. And then I think that what it ultimately boils down to is the burden that shifts, one of persuasion, or is it one of just production of evidence? And, mm-hmm. I mean, this is something that, you know, the courts address and maybe you enjoy writing about, but I came away feeling that I didn't really feel very strongly about
it
either way.
He turns us on.
My thing, Judge. Justice Abramson, I think that you could say it either way. And the reason I concluded in my brief that the burden of persuasion shifts is because I think in many cases the burden of showing hardship clearly is the employer's, and they are so overlapped in many cases that it makes sense to put the burden on the employer. But I think the caveat from one of the cases I cited, which I think makes the most sense here, is that in most cases burden of proof doesn't really matter. And unless the case is a really close case, it doesn't affect the outcome, and maybe we shouldn't worry so much about it. But you asked that I address it, and I did. Now, let's talk about the question of reasonable accommodation in this case. And what about Justice Rogensack's example of the 10 people who come through the door? Well, first of all, I think the reason that this case maybe was attractive to the court in selecting it was here you have a 12-hour job, and this woman can only do 8 hours. So she can only do two-thirds of the job, and isn't that outrageous? Well, first of all, we don't know how outrageous it is because the record doesn't show how they made up those 12 hours or how much cost there was or whether there were overtime required or affiliated.
Where does the standard of outrageous come from? You kind of lost me on that.
Well, just that you can only do two-thirds of the hours. That doesn't.
I mean, why do you say is that outrageous? I mean.
Well, because I think the first blush in this case is here's a 12-hour job. Person can only work 8 hours.
Right.
That's not right. If you look at what the commission ordered, though, in this case, was that she be allowed to work 5 8-hour days each week, and she would then be working an 80-hour schedule, so she'd only be working 4 hours less than the other employees who were working a 12-hour, 7-day schedule, or 84 hours. And there wasn't any showing in this case that allowing her to work that shift, so in effect she's working not this outrageous only two-thirds of everybody else. She'd be working the same virtually as everybody else, but on a different schedule. And the question is, I'm sorry, Justin.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that the issue in this case, in Crystal Lake you said an employer may have to modify job duties as part of the duty of reasonable accommodation. I think maybe you have to modify work schedules and hours, because if you look at the ADA, the definition of reasonable accommodation, those are forms of reasonable accommodation.
Here's my question. Basically, she worked in the photo area of this company. That was then terminated. I mean, it was abolished. It had nothing to do with her. Now, I know that she works. There are three out of the four jobs because of the disability she can't do. So isn't it a question of what I'm having trouble here is that she, wherever she works, this is assembly line work, I assume, assembly line type work, that she would be performing? Or are you talking about desk job?
No, I think it is an assembly line type job. I don't think it's like Crystal Lake in the sense that it isn't four people working together to make one product.
Yeah,
she has a role to play in the production schedule.
Yeah, and I asked if this was factually different, and maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me it is somewhat factually different than Crystal Lake as far as what job she would be performing and how.
Well, you'll have to look at the record. I suggest to you in my brief that the commission's findings and the examiner's findings were that she was able to do those jobs. What your question is premised upon is the argument contained in Hutchinson's brief that she wasn't able to do those jobs. And I think you'll have to reverse the examiner and the commission on certain factual findings, and I'll leave that to the court to review. But it starts in a premise that's different than my own. But just to get back to Justice Rogensack once again, each case, McMullen teaches that each case requires that we look at the specific facts of that case when we make a determination of whether an accommodation is reasonable or imposes a hardship.
Right, but I want you to have the facts be the same. I don't want to change any facts.
Right, and I want you to focus on the facts of this case as well.
Right.
And in this case, the employer didn't show that there would be any significant problem with allowing her to work 5 8-hour shifts. All they said was she'd have to work on two crews with two different supervisors. They didn't say why that was a problem. It's not intuitive. Maybe it's intuitive to the court. It's not intuitive to me why that's a problem. If they had come forward with evidence why it was a problem, that might have been more helpful. But
right.
It's not.
So we got 10 people, and we know what their
response
is.
Let's get to the other 9 people who are going to come
right.
to apply at this company.
Right.
Well, first of all, they're not part of this case, and that's
but
significant.
They are part of how this case will be applied in the future.
They are a part of the next case.
Right. Well, that's
and
what we write
they
for.
Apply, all 9 applied, and they were all rejected at the same time, and they all filed right. complaints, and the complaints right. were all consolidated.
Right.
And the employer then says, in the case, that's not reasonable because, and I'm going to have my supervisors testify about, or my economics people testify about what changes that's going to be, what effect it's going to have on production, what effect it's going to have on employee morale. If there's a bargaining agreement, is it going to conflict with a bargaining agreement? And by the way, just as an aside, I think bargaining agreements reflect another social policy, and that's why the commission has always been careful to dovetail those two. So if there's a conflict.
But I want to keep the facts the same. I don't want you to change them on me. I want you to have the employer give exactly the same responses that the employer gave to Ms. Roytek.
Then I would say that the employer loses. Because
okay,
the employer,
so now they've got 10 people
right.
out of 1,000 that are working 8-hour shifts when they're running a 12-hour line. Can they reasonably send out a notice they want to hire some more folks for this 12-hour line? I mean, when does it get to the point that they've got to change their manner of doing business?
I think it gets to the point when it becomes unreasonable or a hardship. And that depends on the evidence produced in each case. Maybe 10 out of 1,000 would be plausible for that employer. Maybe 1 out of 4 in Crystal Lake might not be plausible. But it depends on reasonableness of the evidence presented by the employer. The commission will make a decision. This court may ultimately review that decision. And so there are checks and balances to make sure that as we add employees, we're not exceeding what's reasonable.
Okay, I have one more question, and I want you to get away too quick. Under 111.34.2a, why is this discrimination? Is it your position that the employee could undertake all the tasks of this job, or that it's not reasonable to make 12 hours a part of this job?
My position on this was answered by the court last term in Crystal Lake, and it was obviously a spirited decision, and the dissenting position would take the view that no modification was necessary in that case, and probably no modification would be necessary in this case. The majority decision says that the duty of accommodation has to be read consistently with this other provision that you've just cited, and that it's permissible to modify in Crystal Lake the job duties, and that may be part of the employer's duty of reasonable accommodation. And in this case, what the commission said and what we urge you to decide is that the duty of accommodation may require a modification of the work hours or a modification of the work schedule. And with those modifications, the employer can do the job. In Crystal Lake, you said the job meant the job with those modifications.
Okay, so you're saying that, but see, that's very circular, because you make a reasonable accommodation then a condition of the job. So you really have quite a circular argument. I mean, Crystal Lake, you had a person and her sister and her mother that were helping her. So for me, it doesn't give me as much guidance as I really wish that it did for this particular
Well, perhaps,
problem.
But the decision, if you read, I mean, and I'm sure you've read Crystal Lake, and I mean
oh, yes.
no disrespect, Your Honor. the holding in that case was not limited to the fact that there was a sister or a mother helping. It was a fairly broad statement of the law because the dissent highlighted what the issues were, what the principles were that were involved in it. It was a well-decided case in the sense that both the dissent and the majority articulated well these concerns. And if you look for the word circular, you'll find it in the dissent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
I have a question for you. You have 10 people applying for a job at HTI. One has a disability and can only work 8 hours. The other nine can work 12 hours. You have to hire the one that can only work 8 hours?
No.
You can hire whoever you think is going to do the job best.
Right. The accommodation goes to whether or not the person can even do the job with a modification. Then you apply whatever your selection criteria are, and you could select by lottery, and it wouldn't be unlawful to not hire the disabled worker.
Thank you.
Mr. Rice, are there any modification of job duties in this case?
My understanding was that there was limited modification of the job duties to the extent that she was permitted to stand and sit in a way that would accommodate her disability. There is a dispute in the record about whether she could still do certain of the functions.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Dittmer.
Members of the court, in response to Justice Rogensack's concerns, which were also echoed by Justice Wilcox, actually, which were originally raised in WMC's portion of this argument, the reason that Hutchinson is up here today is to find out what it can legally do pursuant to the anti-discrimination laws in the state of Wisconsin. Because, as Justice Rogensack has indicated, Lurk's anti-discrimination laws also apply to new hires. So right now, pursuant to Lurk's decision, a person presents who can only work 8 hours a day. We have a 12-hour shift. We have to hire that person. A person presents that can only work 4 hours. We have to hire that person. 2 hours. We have to hire this person. Where does this end? And as Justice Rogensack indicated, what we're left with is a moving target. That we had this affirmative defense that Justice Rogensack indicated and that I had cited in my initial argument indicates that it's not discrimination to terminate or fail to hire for that person an individual who cannot perform his or her job responsibilities that would enable the employee to do the job. And I guess, as Justice Abrahamson indicated, it come to the quick, whose call is it? Whose call is it that there is a 12-hour shift at this plant? Is it the employer's call, who's gone through studies, employee personnel preferences, who's thought that this is the most efficient way to run their plant? Or is that kind of a decision going to be second-guessed by either the courts of this state or the administrative agencies of this state? Now, there is also Attorney Rice had indicated that pursuant to the judge's order, that we were ordered to put this individual back on an 8-hour shift 5 days a week. I don't read the order so stating. It simply indicates that we have to put her back on an 8-hour shift. Indeed, if we were supposed to put her back on an 8-hour shift 5 days a week so she could get what we perceive in the United States of America to be a normal 40-hour week, then she would be working on two different shifts. And as, again, what about that scenario where we have 10 people, and let's just keep it simple, 10 people that can only work 8 hours a day because of a disability, pursuant to the decision that Hutch is under right now, we'd have to hire those individuals or be in violation of the law. Where the heck are we going to schedule these people? It's going to be a scheduling difficulty, and there was testimony, if not more than a difficulty, and there was testimony in the record that indicated that it could get to such an extent that we'd have to hire another person just to do the scheduling here.
Well, that would show hardship, counsel.
But so do we have to then wait, Chief Justice, until we're at a point where we're coming up to the 10th person, and now it's not discrimination to hire the 10th person because we can establish some sort of numbers, economic hardship, but it's okay for that first person? We should be able to put up with one individual, so to speak, that can only work 8 hours, and it's only to the point that we would get to the 10th or 11th person, then we can't deal with it anymore? Or does the employer have, do Wisconsin employers have a right to indicate this is the schedule that we're going to run? And that individuals that have a disability still have to be qualified. And is the ability to work, I submit that the ability to work a 12-hour shift, Chief Justice, is a qualification of this particular job. And again, what employers have to do is see is there some accommodation that we can employ that would enable an individual to meet the job requirements, to meet the 12-hour requirement, and there is none in this case. There is nothing we can do.
Counsel, how do you distinguish Crystal Lake? Your co-counsel here made reference to the fact that there were only a few employees and the mother's sister helping out. But if anything, that seemed to enhance the flip side of the argument. That is, this is, as Justice Wilcox said, this is a much larger company than Crystal Lake, and the reasonableness might be viewed very differently when you're dealing with this kind of proportionality. So how do you distinguish Crystal Lake?
Because, Justice Bradley, even the majority in Crystal Lake agreed that the employer had the right to say, these are the things that need to be done, that need to be accomplished within these jobs. And let's just assume there's four positions there at Crystal Lake, that these are the job responsibilities that have to be accomplished. The majority in Crystal Lake said, we're going to shift those around among these four people, but those are still going to get done. Here, we've got a 12-hour shift, and there's 4 hours where nothing is being done, that we can't shift that to another. Those 4 hours' worth of job responsibilities can't be shifted to another person unless we hire another person, and there's, to my knowledge, there's nothing that requires an employer in the guise of a reasonable accommodation to hire another individual.
Chief, may I follow up? Does that mean that you've put into this record evidence that there's a consequence to this difference? In other words, to me, it sounds like, there means 4 hours of things that can't be done. Ooh, that's a real problem. Have you met a burden of showing that it is an undue hardship or not a reasonable accommodation? The consequence of that is
sure. Justice Bradley, do I have any proof that our production was down for that 4 hours or that I had overtime, anything of that nature? No. But what I do have proof of is how we came up with the 12-hour production schedule in the first place and the reason for that. And that was to meet production goals and to make efficient use of a 24/7 facility. And again, where do we stop? And I see I have the red light in front of me. But, do we stop at the 10th person, the 11th person, the 25th person? I have an employer here that right now doesn't know what to do. They've got to hire anybody pursuant to this ruling and this rationale. They have to hire anybody that walks in the door regardless of what their hour restriction is, and they have to do that unless they can prove statistically, apparently, that that has caused some undue hardship to them. I submit that was never the intent of the anti-discrimination laws that were enacted in the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Ms. Dittmer. Thank you, Mr. Costello and Ms. Allen and Mr. Rice for your argument this morning on Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. We will now end the hearing on 02-3328, Hutchinson Technology versus LIRC. The students may remain here. They will be joined by other students, and I shall be out in a moment to talk with the students. We are in recess until 1:30.